Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome, you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, that's Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
We're in for a treat today. We have a friend of ours, good friend of ours, who stops by once or twice a year with a new book. He is probably one of the hardest working paranormal authors in the field, and he always has great stuff to share with us. He's a paramedic and a paranormal investigator who hails from Great Britain and currently makes his home in the United States. His work has been featured on the TV series Haunted Case Files, Haunted Hospitals, Paranormal 911. And when he's not traveling the world collecting ghost stories and investigating haunted houses, he's writing about those very same places or having fun writing fiction with a distinctly supernatural theme to it. So Richard Estep, Richard Estep joins us. I think it's time we just change your name to Estep to make my life easier, Richard. Because it really is all about me.
I'll get my wife right on that.
Thank you. I'm glad that you guys are still, it's what we talked about this before we even get on the air. We've known you now for, I think, like 10 years and have had you on the show. Yes. And I vacillate between Estep and Estep on every episode. And you're always kind enough to not correct me. So I wanted to make sure we got it right again at the beginning of this. And then immediately out of the shoot, I come out with Estep. So I think it's. I think that's just the way it needs to be, Richard. I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. You know what? I'll go the extra mile for my friends Dave Schrader and Tim Denise.
I like that. That's actually our stripper names. So yeah. Just be careful throwing it out, making it public. Richard, you are a hardworking man. You guys, and your many personalities, I guess, are always involved in something. And I know that you've done the 911 show. You've done the haunted hospitals. Are there more episodes coming out, or are we going to be seeing more of that as well on Travel Channel?
So what I'm hearing right now, and of course, as you know, Travel Channel's like everybody else is rolling with the punch that we've all been given. My understanding is that, there is more Paranormal 911 still to be shown. Paranormal Night Shift, which is my newest show, is half filmed. And so they have half a season of that ready to go. I don't have an air date for that yet, but I'm hoping later this year and production should resume on that pretty soon. And I'm hearing rumors that we may well be seeing a third season of Haunted Hospitals too.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, in talking to you, I said, hey, Richard, love to have you back on. What topic should we talk about? And as always, you give me a great laundry list of topics. How many books do you average writing a year?
Generally speaking, 4 or 5, but I always have several on the go at any given moment. You know, and I'm branching out from the paranormal field a little bit. I just finished the biggest book I've ever written. Really, it's 3 books in terms of size about serial killers, a true crime book. For the nice people at Visible Ink Press, and they just commissioned me to write a history of the U.S. military. So I'm casting a broader net these days, but the paranormal is and always will be my first love.
Well, we will definitely have to have you on True Crime Tuesday to visit about your other book. But and I just want people to know this. Listen, there are a lot of authors that approach us to be on the show that will write 4 or 5 books a year. And then you go look it up on Amazon and you realize the books are like 89 pages long. What you do is a labor of love. These books that you pump out every year and 2 or 3 books, it seems, a year, like this one that we're going to talk about today, 365 pages long. And each page, chock-a-block full of great information, spooky stories, strange encounters. So let's dive into it. The book we're discussing today, The Black Monk of Pontefract. And this has been a story that seems to pop up in our news cycle at least once a year, some kind of weird sighting or experience that's being related back. If you don't mind, Richard, take me back to the very beginning and the history of this story and when it began, not necessarily the lifespan before it, but when we know the haunting began, and give us kind of an idea of just how long it has continued.
Absolutely, Dave. Well, you and I and Tim also, and most of your listeners, I'm sure, we're all familiar with, you know, these ramshackle, historic, old haunted locations, these old manor houses and things. But 30 East Drive is an ordinary house on an ordinary street. You would walk right by it and not know that there was anything particularly unusual about it. The case itself began during the 1960s in a most unusual way. A family lived in the house. They were the second family ever to own it. And when most of them were on holiday one day, the son and his grandmother were home alone. And all of a sudden, a very strange powder began to fall on them from essentially coming from thin air. And it seemed to stratify in this fine layer just below the ceiling, just beneath the ceiling. And things kicked off just like that. That was the precipitating event.
Explain that to me. Like a fine powder just started to rain down from the ceiling?
Yeah. So here's the thing. Not from the ceiling, which would imply, you know, the dust on the ceiling or something. But the way that they described it, it was almost stratified in a layer that was about a foot below the level of the ceiling. Almost like a strange little dust cloud that formed inside their house, apropos of nothing.
Do we know what this material was?
No, we don't. It was never analyzed. And at the time, they wrote it off as one of those strange things, you know, just, I don't know, it's an odd thing happening. They didn't realize that they were seeing the outbreak of what would be 60 years of paranormal activity inside this house.
The reason I'm so blown away by that, this is the second time I've heard a story regarding that exact phenomena. I've heard of water kind of apporting and pouring and strained, like in a closet where there's no pipes or, you know, even in the middle of a room. But this powdery substance, our friends up at the Palmer House in Sauk Center, Minnesota, they have, you know, it's a hotel. It's got a little cafe and a bar. And
it's on my bucket list, too.
Oh, it's amazing. I'll have to connect you because you should definitely talk to them. I think a full definitive book about the Palmer House needs to be written. And Richard, whether it's Richard Estep or Richard Estep that writes it, I don't care which one of your wacky personalities do it. Somebody needs
to
write
it. That guy can write it. I'll take the checks. That's
excellent. But they tell this story. And again, I'm just paraphrasing because it's been a while since I've heard it exactly. In the cafe, while they were open, there was a woman sitting at a table. I believe with her husband, and all of a sudden just this powdery, grainy substance just fell down on her. And they thought, you know, again, coming from the ceiling, but it's not that. It was not anything from the ceiling, and it covered her. And she actually, they saved some of the particulates and gave them to a friend of ours, which you can save for the book. I think we may have mentioned it in a past episode, but I believe that they did do some testing on the particulates, and some of it, I believe, came back. If you remember this, Tim, maybe you can correct me. Didn't some of it come back as biological, like human biological remains?
Like cells?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly how they defined it, but it was something that wasn't just powder or dust or drywall. It wasn't that. It was particulate matter that seemed to be biologic in nature.
I seem to remember that too. Yeah.
So that's weird, but I will definitely, when we get done with today's episode, Richard, I'll connect you with Kelly Fries out at the Palmer House. It is really a great place, and I know Tim and I have had experiences there. We'd be happy to share with your new book. I've already got it lined up for you, so just go ahead and start writing it as soon as we get off the phone today, Richard. All right. No pressure.
Sounds good, Dave. Appreciated.
But forget all the companies that are commissioning to pay you to write books. I'm just telling you, as your friend, you just need to forget them and get right to the book that nobody has bought from you yet.
Well, Dave, because I think that's important. Jump when you say so that's okay.
But that's crazy. So just this dust cloud falls down on her and leaves it. Now, how, you know, was it just like a thin layer, like somebody had, you know, squeezed a talcum powder bottle and it laid down that layer on her, or was she coated in the particulates?
No, exactly that. A very fine layer of powder that fell on the grandmother and the son. And that's when things started to get genuinely strange. They couldn't explain it, but you know how it is. People have this habit of of writing stuff off. You know, I'm sure there is an explanation. I just don't know what it is. And they generally won't delve too much into it. But then the disturbances began. And so they started to hear the cupboard and closet doors opening and closing themselves. They would see that objects would apport and, you know, materializing out of thin air or appear in one place after disappearing in another. And for whatever reason, this entity seemed very, very fond of keys. The family was called the Pritchards. And one morning, Mrs. Pritchard was in the fireplace when all of a sudden a rain of keys came down the chimney, hitting her on the head. A rain of old keys inside this house that's, you know, relatively new. And as far as they were aware, had no reason for these strange things to go on. And the family lived with this for many years. And things started out playfully. You know, you'd see that poltergeist type activity, which begins playfully, but then took a turn for the sinister when the apparition showed itself. And Dave, the source for a lot of this information comes from a book written by a very respected author called Colin Wilson. I'm sure you've heard of Colin. He was a master of the field. Yeah. And he wrote a book called Poltergeist, A Study in Destructive Haunting. Now, this goes far beyond your typical poltergeist haunting, but he made this this haunting very well known, and it was international news. In fact, there's a small stretch of grass and a few trees outside the house. People were camping out there at night after this made the news, hoping to catch a glimpse of this infamous ghost.
Now, the strange apportation of items that would just appear, these weren't keys that maybe fit the house at one time.
So these were keys that generally came from an unknown source. I mean, I know that one or two belongs to the family, and those things continue to this day, although whatever it is that's active at 30 East Drive seems to love marbles. Police officers have been to the house and have had marbles thrown at them out of thin air. And a number of visitors have reported the same thing. And so I need to kind of go a little further down the timeline with this, and we can talk about the initial outbreak of the haunting in more depth, but as we go along, the case kind of went a little bit dormant. The Pritchard family that lived there and underwent so much of this stuff, finally kind of their kids grew up, they moved out, they went their separate ways. Mr. Pritchard died in the house. He died of a heart attack upstairs in the bathroom at the top of the stairs. And Mrs. Pritchard lived there into her old age. Now, Pontefract is in a mining part of the country. So Mr. Pritchard was a miner, and this was a mining family. And I'm sure you know, if you've ever met miners, these are a very hardy people. You know, they're not the kind that will cut and run from danger or from any kind of fear. So Mrs. Pritchard lived in that house for decades on her own. Her only concession, really, to the strange events that were still going on sporadically was that she had locks put on a number of the interior doors. And she would live primarily in one of the downstairs rooms, along with her pet bird. And then finally, around about 2013-14, they made a movie about this case. It's actually a pretty good movie. It's called When the Lights Went Out. And I encourage you guys to have a watch if you can. I watched it in the house, which was genuinely creepy. But the movie took the case of the Black Monk. They filmed it on a soundstage, not on location. And the producer of the film, a man called Bill Bungay, who was my fellow author, came from a background of advertising. You know, he was looking for a way to publicize his movie. And he said, I wonder what happened to the actual house. And so he did some research, did some digging, and found that it was actually up for sale and was not all that expensive, all things being equal. So he thought, I don't think anybody's ever done a movie premiere in the haunted house that the movie is about before.
Wow.
So he bought the place. I know, right? He bought the place. And he'll be the first to tell you, Bill was, he's an open-minded man, but wasn't, you know, a ghost person, wasn't into this kind of stuff. So he was healthily skeptical, and he figured this is a great PR stunt, and that was really the extent of his plans. You know, he certainly had no idea that the house was still very, very active. So they held the premiere there, and that's when he started to hear about the figure of the monk, the ghost that's behind all this, still being in the house to this day.
So he buys this house for the PR, the fun of it, and then mm-hmm. realizes that this isn't just a case that was part of history, but a haunting that continues on today.
And he experienced it personally and had a number of personal encounters. For example, one night he had a TV crew coming
in. Hold on one second. Before we get too close into what's happened recently, take me back, though. You said all these strange things would happen, the deportations, the dust coating. When the spirit, this entity, first made its presence known, do we have an idea of around what year that was?
We do. So 1966 is the year that this all kicks off and starts to get very active, and it continues for the next few years through the end of the decade. And so we've talked about things already, like the fairly innocuous stuff, the keys and so forth. Pot plants would levitate up the stairs as if they were being carried by an invisible person. And people came from far and wide to see this. You know, there were, Colin Wilson interviewed a number of very credible witnesses, including local pastors, you know, priests, a number of times. And several people said, we've just seen the most bizarre things in this house, things that we can't explain. And you've mentioned the water phenomena earlier, Dave. You know, those were prevalent at 30 East Drive as well, these unexplained appearances of water and so forth. But what really kind of cemented this character of the Black Monk was that one day this tall, dark, hooded figure emerged from the wardrobe in the Pritchard's master bedroom upstairs and was seen several times throughout the house by multiple witnesses. One occasion was sinking through the floor, as though he was kind of descending, you know, below ground level. And also, 30 East Drive is directly connected to another house next door. They're divided by a common support wall, like a duplex house. And phenomena was also taking place in that house, and also continues to do so to this day. And we can talk about that a little bit later on. But things took a turn for the dark, as they sometimes do in these cases. And you know, just to preface this very quickly, Dave, you know, I'm not one of these people that says every haunting is a dark haunting, right? Even though that's what sells, we know that there are many cases in which these phenomena are, you know, misinterpreted. But at the same time, the daughter of the family, Diane, the teenage daughter, was dragged upstairs, up the stairs by an invisible force in full view of several witnesses. And so the family started to live in fear. And one of the ways they combated the fear
started to live in fear. My God, it grabbed the daughter, dragged her up the stairs by her hair. Was that not enough for the family to decide, you know, we need to get the hell out of here?
You know, Mr. Pritchard, now he had his road to Damascus moment around that same time. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. But again, this is a hardy mining family. You know, miners are not generally people that will cut and run. And certainly Mrs. Pritchard, who lived there for decades, when asked about why would you stay in this house, especially after your family left, she said, I'm not being chased out of this house by no ghost. This is my home. You know, so that's the mindset. And hats off to Mrs. Pritchard for not being pushed around.
It's always easy to say when you're not the one being dragged up the stairs by your hair, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, but imagine being alone in the house with something that can do that. And she was for many years. So, you know, she was a very brave woman, which is why we dedicated the book to her, actually. Mrs. Pritchard is still alive, by the way. She just lives a little bit down the road in assisted housing, is my understanding. But anyway, the phenomena started to turn violent. The family nicknamed the ghost Fred. They wanted the most innocuous, everyday, you know, mundane name to help take some of the sting of fear out of this. So they began to refer to it as Fred. Fred's up to his old tricks again. You know, Fred's walking around at night. And an aunt of the family, I believe it was, came in. This is kind of a funny story. Came into the house and was expressing her skepticism. And all of a sudden, an object started to float into the air. I believe it was a milk jug, but don't quote me on that. I'd have to go back and check. Anyway, so she started to sing. She started to sing the song Onward Christian Soldiers, you know, deciding to invoke the Lord against what she saw as this evil spirit. And a pair of gloves, which had been laying on the sideboard, actually floated up around the door frame, and they started moving in time with the music as if they were conducting it. But the hand span was greater than that of any human being. So if these had been on the end of actual arms, this thing would have had to have had arms far wider than a living person could.
Yikes. You're right. It's got a comical flair to it. But then when you take all the other aspects of it into perspective, that's got to be kind of horrifying.
Well, and to take that one step further, what happened to Mr. Pritchard? So he was a miner, as I said, and many houses that miners lived in had what was called a coal hole, which was essentially a closet. But one of the perks of being a coal miner was that you got an allowance of coal to take home. You know, if you work in a dairy, you get to take milk home. It's one of those kind of deals. So you would heat your house essentially for free throughout the winter and store the coal in this small closet inside the house. And that coal hole is still there. We should talk about that later on. But one day, Mr. Pritchard Joe went into the coal hole. The door slammed itself shut behind him, and he was attacked. He was physically assaulted by, again, some unseen force. And those that knew him at the time have said that he emerged from that experience just 5 minutes later, a completely changed and broken man.
That deep and impactful. An experience.
Well, again,
huh?
Yeah, but remember, if you're the kind of guy that, you know, rough and tumble, right? You live with my fist. If I can hit it, I'm not afraid of it. And that mindset doesn't work with the paranormal, does it? I've seen many, as I'm sure you guys have, many, you know, very strong individuals that are not afraid of anything that lives and breathes, terrified by something that apparently doesn't live or breathe.
Yeah, that's well, you're right on that. And we know cops that are, you know, and law enforcement people that are afraid or not afraid to go into buildings where they know there are armed gunmen, but they go to a house where their footsteps being heard in the attic. They go up and there's nobody there, and then they hear it. They get out of that house pretty damn quick.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do not have any disrespect for those kind of people. We all have a different tolerance for different things in life, don't we? So, you know, Mr. Pritchard, but that's when he could no longer deny it. I mean, there had been apparitions, there had been levitations, you name the phenomena, it had been there, but it finally literally hit him on the nose. And he could no longer deny it. And also, I think, not to psychoanalyze too much, but as the head of a family, to be assaulted in your own home and not be able to do anything about it has to just be a crushing experience.
Oh, yeah, I don't even want to consider what that would be like. I mean, that's, again, something that's so violent, something that's so powerful that it's making itself known in so many different ways. That's got to, I can't even believe how overwhelming that has to be for the family that lives there.
And he's not the only one to be assaulted in the coal hole. Just a few decades later, and we're jumping ahead a little bit, but Nick Groff and Katrina Weidman stayed in the house for 72 hours and received scratches when they were locked in the coal hole also. Very same place.
So that power of an entity like that still exists in that home. It makes you wonder what A, holds them there, or B, what attracts the energy to stay in a place like that?
Well, and let's dispel a huge myth, if we can, Dave, because if you look at this case on the internet, and even if you read Colin's book, you know, at the time, the whole black monk thing comes from the fact that there was an orchard in this area hundreds of years ago, and monks did tend to some flowers there, fruit there and so forth. But there is a story out there that seems to trace its origin to one local individual. Okay, that's your source, one individual. The story is, and it's all over the net, if you look, it's been printed in books many times as well, that one of these monks was a thoroughly perverse and evil individual and supposedly raped and murdered a young girl in the area of what is now 30 East Drive and threw her body down a well on the site. Now, there are variations of this story, but one says that the locals basically found him, killed him, and put his body down the well also. And this would be the infamous Black Monk of Pontefract. And that's why this robed hooded figure, you know, haunts the house so many years after, and why he seems malevolent, and why he would attack the young lady of the family when the Pritchards were living there. So it's a great ghost story, and it would be even more so if it were true, but there's not a shred of evidence to support this wild story, none whatsoever. Several witnesses have said that they've seen a well underneath the house that during construction work during the 1960s, a couple of the neighbors who were kids at the time insist that they saw a well underneath the house that there is one there, but it's never been excavated, so its presence has never been objectively verified. But who in their right mind poisons a well by throwing a body into it? You know, it just doesn't add up. But this myth has been propagated as fact over and over again across the internet.
Another week has gone by, and did you spend it gritting your teeth and gnashing them and hoping that you'd get through pain-free, or did you actually do something about it? Did you get yourself towards a better journey through life without pain and anxiety? I'll tell you what I did. I spent my week with Feels. Hey, it's your buddy Timmy. And I want to talk to you a little bit about Feels CBD, premium CBD that'll help you get rid of stress, anxiety, chronic pain, and finally getting a good night's sleep. I know a lot of you who are listening out there experience stress. You have anxiety. You've got that chronic pain going, or you have trouble sleeping at least once a week. You're not alone. Many of us do. Personally, I've told you before, everything but that tip of that pinky on my left hand hurts like you wouldn't believe. If I got to grade my pain, anywhere from a 7 to a 13 out of 10 scale. That's where my pain sits from day to day. And I know a lot of you can relate. I know there's a lot of you out there that have chronic pain. I see your emails. I read your emails. I respond to your emails. I know that a lot of you ask a lot of the same stuff. Tim, does this Feel stuff really work? This premium CBD, is it really everything it's cracked up to be? And yes, it is. It's everything it's cracked up to be and more. It truly is real. It truly does get you out of pain. It truly does help your anxiety. It truly does help you get some sleep. If it didn't, I wouldn't be telling you about it. I wouldn't be here giving you the 411 on this stuff. It's real simple. Feels is premium CBD, and it's delivered directly to your doorstep. No searching for this stuff that will get you out of pain, that'll get you out of anxiety, that'll get you into a good night's sleep. It shows up right to your doorstep. Feels naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And I tell you, with me, it's real simple. I take it twice a day. And it complements everything that I'm doing to get myself out of pain. I'm able to sit here and do these podcasts. I record for hours upon hours. It used to be that I couldn't sit in a chair for more than half an hour. I couldn't stand for more than 10 minutes. I had a lot of problems, folks, just sitting still, laying still, standing for more than 10 minutes. Feels CBD has gotten me to be able to sleep at night, to be able to stand for more than 5-10 minutes at a time. And it does that by bringing down that inflammation, by helping me with not only my short-term pain, but my long-term pain as well. CBD is a godsend, and Feels Premium CBD is that premium godsend that will absolutely help you and your pain and your anxiety. Feels naturally helps reduce that stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. I tell you, with me, I have a lot of it. Not only do I have that short-term pain and those herniated and bulging discs, but I've also got arthritis everywhere. My body's riddled with arthritis in my hands and my knees and my ankles and my spine, in my neck. Every time I turn around, I'm in pain. If I wasn't in pain, I'd know I was dead. That's the only way I know. When I don't feel pain anymore, I know I'm dead. But Feels helps relieve that pain. It gets me going again. I take a dropper full in the morning when I wake up. I take a dropper full in the evening when it's time to go to bed. And I'm on my way. I'm on my way and I'm doing my thing, or I'm on my way and I'm going to sleep. It's real easy to take. If you've never taken CBD before, with you, you're going to place a few drops of Feels under your tongue. You're going to feel the difference within minutes. And the thing to remember about CBD is that you're going to find the right dose when you do this. Now, finding the right dose is important. And everyone's dose is different. Like I said, I take a dropper full. I've been doing this for a while. You're going to find your dose maybe somewhere between a few drops and a dropper full, or maybe a little bit more. Leave some room to experiment over the course of a week or so. You may need to take more or less depending on the effects you're after, but you'll get there. You'll find out what your dose is. And you know what? If you don't know what your dose is, or you're having a hard time getting your dose down, the folks at Feels are right there for you on every step of the way. You're going to have real human support from the folks at Feels. They've got a free CBD hotline to help guide you through that personal experience. They are amazing. The folks at Feels will get you there every step of the way. And that's what I love about Feels. feel better naturally. It works naturally. Feels helps you feel better. There's no high, no hangover, no addiction. I tell you, I go to a pain clinic and I've been on those pills. I've felt logy after those pills. I've had days where I can't get out of bed because of those pills. You know it. I know it. We've both been there. CBD doesn't give you that. It's like taking ibuprofen. And Feels will get you there to the point where you're not feeling that hurt anymore. It's real easy. How do you get in on this? Simple. Join the Feels community to get the Feels delivered directly to your door every month. You're going to save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. Although I say this every week, I don't know why you'd want to pause or cancel once you're out of pain. But hey, if you want to do it, you can. Feels has me feeling my best every day. It can help you too. Here's how you do it. Become a member today by going to feels.com/darkness. We're going to give you 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/darkness to become a member. Get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. One more time, feals.com/darkness. Do yourself a favor right now. I know you're grinning and bearing it. You think you're being brave, but you're not. You're suffering needlessly. Get out of that habit. Take away the stress. Take away the anxiety. Get rid of the chronic pain. Start sleeping, for gosh sakes. Go get yourself some Feels today. feals.com/darkness. Get 50% automatically taken off your first order. Free shipping. Do it today.
As we're talking about the Black Monk and the history and mystery surrounding it, is it frustrating for you as an author to hear these great stories, start digging into it, and realize that there's really no teeth to this? Or is that equally intriguing to you? I always find that fascinating when doing the investigations on the Holzer files, is hearing the stories only to realize they're not true. But I think there's a really interesting aspect to who we are as humans to need to have a backstory all the time, whether it's one that we imagine or one that we just propagate through, whispers and hushed tones that others have put forth. That's almost as important to a haunting as the actual encounter or history of the place itself.
Well, and you hit the nail on the head, Dave. When we investigate these locations, just being there is a privilege. Even if nothing out of the ordinary happens, you know, I'd read about this case since I was a boy. I'd read Colin's book when I was 8 years old, and I'd always wanted to go to 30 East Drive. So it was a dream come true for me. But I'm interested in the truth. And if the truth is less glamorous, you know, if the truth would make it wouldn't make a great scary movie, but the story is what the story is. And that's certainly what we want to bring to light. I also think, though, if you consider the fact that this story of the Black Monk has been told over and over again inside the house, and it's been believed to be fact. So there's this possibility that a thought form has been created, that the story can take on a life of its own. And I do kind of wonder if there isn't some opportunistic entity there that either is latching onto this and passing itself off as this character, or if Fred, for want of a better term, has actually been created by the sheer number of times this story has been told as fact. We saw this at Malvern Manor, which I know we covered on the show a few years ago, with Inez, the young girl that was supposedly hanged in the manor and whose ghost has been seen and communicated with, except we discovered that Inez never died there. She died several blocks away in a private residence. So why would she haunt this place? And it's because her story has been told so many times.
Right. Or just the fact that, you know, if this was a place that she enjoyed at some point, you might think that they would come back to it. But I wonder, Richard, it seems to me when I've been over in Europe and Britain and talked to the people there, they believe in the paranormal in a slightly different way than maybe we do here in America. And there's a belief more in things like elementals, you know, things that were never human, but continue to be a part of our earth. Could it be that this isn't really a cloaked figure, but something that is this anomalous blob, if you will, but we're putting a sense to it that it looks like a large cloaked image. and something that we would make, you know, try to make sense of. Do you think there's any opportunity to, or not opportunity, but do you think there's any concept where what we're seeing is not necessarily a human or ever walked in human form, but more of this amorphous, nondescript being? So it has no actual form to take, and therefore it would look to all from the outside as though it might be a hooded character.
You mean the equivalent of a chameleon, for want of a better term?
Right. I mean, it's just something that we see, like, you know, and I'm bringing this in the mind of pareidolia, right? When we look at an oil slick and we see the Virgin Mary, or we look at the, you know, the bark of a tree and it looks like Elvis, right? There's, our eyes are always looking for recognizable forms. Well, if it's really something that's just this amorphous kind of being that has no real form to it, but it's tall and, you know, it, in the dark, has this more cloaked look to it, we're kind of superimposing onto it, projecting this image of a monk because it's, you know, it's not a humanistic form. So we're giving it all. It must be this dark monk, because as you said, the history doesn't really necessarily line up with what's going on there. Or is the monk there? You know, this has been my thought on this since hearing about this years ago. Is the monk there not necessarily as the evil force, but the monk is there trying to keep whatever evil or dark manifestation at bay to a degree? Is it there to try to stop it down?
That's a very astute observation, and I think it's entirely credible. I also think that more than one entity is resident at 30 East Drive. One piece of the history that is verifiable, though, is that 30 East Drive sits on what's called the Checkerfield Estate. An estate, you know, is just a subdivision, essentially. And it's so named because during the English Civil War, the Battle of Checkerfield took place on this site. So the house is on a battlefield as well, with all of the baggage that that brings along with it. I think that you have almost the perfect storm here. And I don't know why the original outbreak or the original incidents occurred, but I do firmly believe that since Bill bought the house and has opened it up to paranormal investigators, and it's a very popular location, so literally hundreds of people come through there every year with their own expectations. You know, some experience nothing at all. Others run from the house screaming with every reaction in between. But I do think, yeah, we're constantly feeding this. And I think there may be more than one entity at work. It may well be that a monk is being protective. It may well be that there is something non-human. And that's supported by the fact that a team that I'd spoken to directly at the location had recorded very clearly the sound of growling, animalistic growling, coming from inside the coal hole when there was nobody in it.
So many layers. That's what's so fascinating about these hauntings, right? We have no definitive answer. We seem to slot these concepts into different positions and perhaps give attribute different things to different spirits because it makes us feel better that we then have a better handle on what it is we're dealing with, when really, as you said, battlefields, churchyards, homes, whatever, there's so many rich textures to this area that have taken place there over the years, that this could be the perfect, you know, witch's cauldron boiling and roiling with paranormal activity from different levels that all seem to be sparking at different times and creating different visions or aspects of what has happened there at other points in history.
Layer upon layer, absolutely. And, you know, a number of investigators have reported interacting with what appears to be a young child inside the house, so you have that as well. Of course, going back to your theory, Dave, or your premise, it could well be you have this one entity that's capable of appearing however it wants to appear in order to suit its own purposes. And we know there are many people in this field that will tell you when you think you're dealing with the spirit of a child, it may be something far different and far darker. Or it may well be, you know, something that just wears many faces, as you said, and presents whichever one suits it the best, depending on who it's dealing with.
Going through the different types of hauntings here and encounters, what are some of the more startling aspects that you uncovered in the book?
Well, I like to talk about personal experiences, and I did deal with many witnesses, and I'm happy to share some of their experiences. But I moved into the house for what would ultimately be 5 days and nights. And Bill, to his credit, you know, no money changed hands. He did not ask for anything. He said, I just want you to tell this story truthfully, you know, and if nothing happens, nothing happens. But that's all I'm asking. So I'm always wary when somebody says, yeah, come write about my haunted house and make it, you know, more famous. Well, 30's Drive doesn't need to be made more famous. It's an infamous house already. So I found it a very credible haunting to begin with. You know, hundreds of eyewitnesses.
Right.
So I flew over from the States.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's do this then. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll join Richard Estep as he spends 5 days in this very haunted house. What happens next? Stay tuned to find out right here on Darkness Radio.
You know, we all need a break now and then, but why not keep your brain active while you relax? That's why I love the fun puzzle game Best Fiends. It's an oasis of fun that you can take with you everywhere. And when I need some me time, Best Fiends is a fun escape from the everyday challenges that we're facing now. We got pandemics, we got murder hornets, we've got all kinds of challenges going on around us. But I like to take the fun challenge of Best Fiends. And let me tell you, I've been spending a lot of time lately just kind of getting away with Best Fiends. And I've got it on my portable devices. I've got an iPad and an iPhone that I play Best Fiends on. And I've been getting into it a lot lately and just kind of taking time away and playing a level or two at a time and really getting into Best Fiends. Now, I've collected a little cadre, if you will, of characters. And going after those slugs, those evil slugs. And I've got 10 fiends that I've collected. Now, there's 149 characters overall that you can collect in the game. And I've got 10 characters that I've collected overall. And I've got three of my favorites that I like to go after these slugs with. And I want to tell you a little bit about these little characters that I've collected. Three of my favorites. I've got Temper. And he's like a little green character. And he's got a horizontal bomb that you can go after these slugs with. And it's a dangerous little horizontal bomb that Temper fires off. I've got Gordon, who's like a little red scorpion. And Gordon fires off his bombs. And these are all level 10. I've got them all. You can power them up to different levels. So you've got different power levels. And 10, actually, they can go up as high as you can power them up. It goes beyond a level 10, believe it or not, but I've got them all up to level 10 right now. And I know it sounds like I'm not speaking English, but I am. Once you get in the game, you'll understand. But Temper's at a level 10. Gordon's at a level 10. He's my little red scorpion, and he fires off his scorpion bombs. And he's at a level 10, and he can take out his slugs. And then I've got Pop. And I'm kind of partial to Pop because, you know, my stepdad passed away over 10 years ago now. So Pop is like a little purple fish. And he's my favorite. He's my big time favorite. And he looks like a little purple fish. And Pop fires off a vertical bomb, and he's a level 10 as well. And I like to pull out Pop when I'm in a situation where I know I need to clear out these slugs and I look like I'm in a tough situation. Now, I just recently got out of the Frozen Hills, and Frozen Hills is like about 50, I think it's like 50, almost 60 levels deep. And I've just gotten out of the Frozen Hills, and now I'm into the Endless Desert, which is right around level 60, 61, somewhere in there. And I'm pushing my way through the Endless Desert right now. And it gets tougher, and it gets more challenging, and the patterns change. Not only have you got the slugs to fight, but you've also got the puzzles, which change as well. And the puzzles become more difficult as well. And you'll see when you get into the game, and I encourage you to play along with me when you download Best Fiends, that it becomes more challenging. Everything changes and it becomes different. There's not two different puzzles that are alike. And you start recognizing patterns, and the patterns change. And it really does become something different that challenges your brain, and everything just becomes different. There's no two things that are the same. And I've encouraged my friends to play, my family to play, and you guys to play and to get online and play against me. I know I've challenged quite a few people on social media to play with me as well. It's become quite a cool game for us all to play as a community. And you can play with me too. It's real easy as to how you can do it. And keep in mind now, you don't have to be hooked up to social media to play this game. You could play it on your own without having to hook up to the internet. You don't require the internet to play. So you don't need to worry about Wi-Fi access or using cell data. You can play it while you're traveling. it's not necessary to have the internet to do so, but it's kind of fun to have social media so you can play against your friends and family as well. What's cool is Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events. It never does get old. This game is amazing, folks, and you're going to absolutely love it. It challenges you on different levels, like I said, with the puzzles, with the slugs, with different events and levels. It's something else. You got to see it for yourself. It's a unique and exciting puzzle experience, unlike other puzzle games out there. And these characters are just too cute. And you get a chance to take care of them, level them up, and go through these different experiences with these characters. It's really something else. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips. You can even play offline. It's something that you really want to get into. And come play along with Dave and I. We encourage you to come play Best Fiends with us right now. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends for free right now on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
We're back. Our guest, Richard Estep, as we're talking about his book, The Black Monk of Pontefract. Oh, God, it's easier to read than it is to say. Pontefract. And hearing about the chilling experiences and the history of the home, Richard decides to put the story to the test. And you're going to stay 5 nights in this house. Is that right?
Yep. 5 days and nights in this house with a very small team of investigators that I work with closely. And a few local experts on the house also that kindly volunteered their time. Because I believe it's good to immerse yourself in a location, you know, Dave, just so you can, it can get used to you and you can get used to it.
I agree. Right. If you go in there on one night, sometimes that's not enough to have, they're more interested in kind of watching you after a few nights. Sometimes it'll get more familiar and make itself known. So I completely agree with that. Well, walk us through how soon after setting up and getting into the house do you realize that this house may be living up to its legend after all?
Well, one of the most frustrating things, and I think one of the most unusual things about writing books as opposed to TV work is when you're doing a TV show, you know, you have a climax to the show, right? Things build and build and build, and ultimately you kind of present your conclusion, and big stuff often happens after you've been there a while. We got hit almost the moment we walked in the house, within the first hour. So I flew in from Denver with a couple of close friends, Jason and Linda. My friend Charlie came from the States, and our colleague Andrew joined us from the UK. We go to the house, and we meet one of the caretakers there. There's a team on site called East Drive Paranormal that look after the house and do research on a voluntary basis. And they made us a cup of tea. I walked through the house and I searched it. I searched the house top to bottom. And without telling a soul, Dave, because I'm a kind of a suspicious man, I took a voice recorder and I hid it, started it running, and I hid it behind the grandmother clock at the top of the staircase. You know, because you just never know, right? From minute one, you set foot in this location, you never know what's going to happen and when. And Murphy's Law says you won't have a voice recorder running because you've gotten caught up in other things. So Bill, the owner, stick his head around the door about 10 minutes after we arrived, and it was funny. I watch people, Dave, all the time. I'm a keen observer of people as a paramedic because I get lied to a lot. And I think that's true also as a paranormal investigator. We deal with people that either are trying to sell us a story, you know, or sometimes garner some attention, or are well-meaning, but perhaps aren't critically thinking about what's happening to them, and that's okay. So I watch people's body language, and Bill, who, you know, I've come 5,000 miles to see him, rather than greet me, the first thing he does when he walks in, he very nervously walks into the kitchen, looks up at the ceiling and goes, "Fred, it's me, it's Bill. Don't hurt me, okay? I'm just here to show these nice people around." Yeah, and I'm like, he genuinely appears to be afraid of what's in his house. You know, and Bill has never spent a night at 30 East Drive. He says he never will. He'll only come there during the daylight and evening hours if he can help it. So anyway, Bill said, listen, before you get cracking on this, let's go get some lunch, okay? He gave me the key. I locked up the house, and we went to get lunch. We were gone an hour. Walked back in the house. I unlocked the door. I came through first, through the kitchen, into the hallway, and there at the foot of the stairs is this mirror that has been hanging on the wall for many years, and it is completely smashed. It's on the floor at the foot of the stairs, and it's smashed. And my first thought is, gotcha. Because I know exactly what's happened here, Dave. You know, and my heart's kind of sinking already because I'm thinking, this is a setup, right? The guy has given me the keys to the house. You know, of course he has a spare set. Who doesn't? He's going to get us out of the way, and then he's going to have a buddy of his, a cohort, come in. I know there was nobody in the house because I searched it, but he's going to have somebody come in, probably texted them while we were eating, you know, break an object, make it look spectacular, and there's credibility, right? All to the good. But I've got that recorder running, so I'm going to catch him. So first thing I do is I go up the stairs, pull the recorder into a bedroom, close the door, throw on the noise-canceling headphones, and I listen. And I'm waiting for that sound of a door opening slightly, you know, that creak, the sound of footsteps on floorboards. No matter how quiet you try to be, you make some kind of noise. And also, nobody knew I'd left a recorder running. And what I hear is silence, 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 smash. So nobody came into that house. We tried to debunk it. I had everybody on my team come in from the outside with the same recorder running in the same spot. We could not get to the foot of the stairs without making a noise by opening a door or a window, without making a noise on the floorboards. It's just not possible. We tried to debunk it, and we couldn't. And the mirror was hung by a very sturdy piece of rope on the back. Hadn't frayed or anything like that. This had been yanked off the wall and smashed at the foot of the stairs within an hour of us first arriving.
Do you think it's because it was upsetting to the spirits that there was going to be something going on there? I know, again, this is just this is all just conjecture, but why do you think that it was showing such a display and a force?
Well, I'd made very clear that this was one of my dream locations to write about. And so I'm always respectful when I go to a property, and I always try and tell the story of the people that live there and what may still live there as openly as I can. I almost wonder if it wasn't a case of whatever's in the house saying, okay, you know, you want to write something, you want to tell a story, I'll give you something to write about. Boom.
Well, it certainly seems to be off to a good start. Now you've got that, you've heard the recording, so you realize that there is definitely something to this story. What happens next?
Absolutely. Well, we kind of split up. We get used to the house a little bit, you know, checking out each of the different rooms, just getting a feel for the place. And I'm freaked out. It's still the most frightening place I've ever investigated, but not for the reason that you would think. It has nothing to do with ghosts. Bill has outfitted this house. It's almost a time capsule from the 1970s, to the point where he even has Betamax videotapes on the sideboard.
Wow.
So it Betamax. Really is.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and you remember that funky old 70s wallpaper everybody had, and only 5 years old again. Like, I'm that kid that's about to hide behind the sofa because Doctor Who's coming on TV at Saturday night at 6, you know? It was very visceral for me. I was very uncomfortable there all the time. But I'm wise enough to realize that that's a personal thing. I don't think it's anything to do with the paranormal, you know? Other than that, the house seems to be pretty welcoming at first. And then my friend Charlie, who he had some jet lag, so he slept that off, and then We're eating inside the house, you know, we're making tea inside the house to keep going through the night. Charlie's standing at the sink in the kitchen, and I happen to be sitting in the living room right next door, and he goes, somebody's grabbing me by the ankles. This is strange. So we all pile into the kitchen. He's standing there looking around. He says, now my back's on fire. No, seriously, it feels like my back's burning up. And I go over to him, and I lift up his shirt, and I watch and also record with my thermal camera, these three very hot, angry scratch marks appear across his lower back from his right, about the kidney level, down towards his left buttock. And they appear right in front of our eyes.
So you're seeing this happen in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And you catch it on video.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And I put photographs in the book. I put a thermal camera on. just watching the watching this thing grow redder and redder and redder. And your first thought, honestly, just to be skeptical, is going to be, you know, has somebody scratched themselves for attention? I mean, leaving aside the fact that Charlie's not that kind of guy, you know, and I've no reason to suspect him. That's what a skeptic's going to say. But we're watching these things come up. So, you know, I found that very impressive indeed. And he wasn't doing anything other than washing some dishes and putting the teapot on. So it was interesting to me that he felt anchored to the spot as if something had grabbed his ankle and was holding him in place. And then he feels the burning in his lower back.
All right. Now, at one point during an investigation, when you see a teammate attacked like that, this is something I know investigators around the world ask. And, you know, I'm in these situations as well with Cindy and Shane. At what point do you say enough's enough? The risk of our own physical health is not worth the juice. You know, the squeeze isn't worth the juice in this situation, and exit a location like this.
I'm the wrong person to ask, Dave, and I'll tell you why. This is something that I try and be very wary of all the time with my own wife. My wife has an administrative job. She works in an office. So being married to a paramedic, one of the big faults that we have is that if you've had a bad day at work, our idea of a bad day at work is very different. Do you know what I mean? Our idea of an emergency is very different to most people. Now, Charlie is also a paramedic, as it happens. And Jason is a former EMT. So when it comes down to injuries and stuff like that, it doesn't worry us in terms of the physical injury. If anything, I'm a little more worried about the attachment side of things, you know, the spiritual consequences of it. That's what I'm more concerned about, and making sure that we do a good cleansing and do some protective work when we leave the location. But the physical aspect of it, the trauma aspect of it, doesn't really worry me overly.
I guess, is there a point, though, do you think you would ever get to, is there something, I guess, I'm trying to find the right way to phrase this, because, you know, obviously we all want to seem like macho investigators, but is there ever a point you think you would say, hey, you know what, this place just isn't safe for me or anybody else to be in, and would cause you to leave? Obviously, scratching across the back and butt doesn't seem to worry you. What would be that line for you? Would it have to be somebody being shoved in front of you down a flight of stairs? And I don't just mean you in particular. I mean, what do you think would be enough for a paranormal team to say, you know, out of respect, we just need to get out of here?
You know, it happened to me recently. I did a case in Illinois at the John Wayne Gacy haunting of the R Movie Theater. And the owner of the movie theater, and I'm not breaking a confidence, this went in the book. He gave me his permission. Wonderful guy, Robin Terry. Robin said, so the only concern I have when people try and communicate with Gacy, he said, I have a heart condition and that usually exacerbates it. And I'm like, don't be here or we won't do that. You know, why would I risk? There's nothing worth risking exacerbating a heart condition for. And I've also heard a couple of stories anecdotally of spirits or entities that seem to be able to interfere with pacemakers if you have an implanted pacemaker. So those are of great concern to me. But you're right, Dave, if someone's being physically shoved, if someone seems to be in danger of being pushed down a flight of stairs and breaking their neck, I would say that goes too far. It's a risk I'm happy assuming myself, but I would not presume putting that on anybody else.
Oh, don't put that out to the universe. Don't even say stuff like that, Richard. Come on. Ugh. It worries me that then one of these ghosts are going to be like, oh, you think it's okay for you? All right. Here's your time. Yeah.
Let's modify that. Were that to happen, and I hope it doesn't, do that to Richard Estep, okay?
Yeah, Estep, not Estep. Leave him alone. He's a good guy.
Yeah, Estep's off limits.
All right. So you watch a scratch. You know, how do you deal with that at the moment then? Do you have to remove that investigator from the scene for a little bit and give them a chance to kind of mentally and physically recover from that? Or do you just sink in even deeper, dig your heels in and not go to war, but, you know, I mean, let the spirit realize it doesn't have the power to scare you out.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie was not particularly perturbed by it, honestly. Again, I've worked with him in a lot of different cases and on some genuine emergencies. So I hate to say this because it sounds so superficial, but he found it more exciting than worrying. you know? So we were entrenched there, but I'm not a big believer in provocation. I try and be respectful. So we set boundaries and said, we don't want you harming us. You can move things. You can touch us within reason. You know, you can interfere with our equipment. We would love it if you would show yourself, but do not inflict any injuries or any physical harm on any of us. And it did not for the rest of our stay. We didn't have anything else of that nature.
Why do you think that is, Richard? And again, I don't mean to interrupt the flow, but why do you think it is that just by setting the intention, hey, you can interact with us, but you cannot hurt us. If it's something dark and malevolent, what does it care if you want, you know, if you're giving it permission? If it's going to hurt you, it's going to hurt you.
Well, I've often thought, Dave, that a lot of the time we think something is dark and malevolent because it's, you know, scratching and touching and it's something we can't see. It's entirely possible this is a human spirit that is trying to communicate in one of the few ways it knows how, in a very clumsy way. I'm not somebody that believes that every scratch comes from something non-human or, you know, quote-unquote demonic.
Great. Even when I got knocked on my ass at the Whaley House, it would have been very easy to assume this was something dark and demonic. I think what it was just an irritated ghost letting me know it wasn't. It was digging its heels in. I'm not going to let you push me around. You're not going to show me disrespect. I've already had enough disrespect, and it gave me a good shove. So we do try to right our own ships when we're investigating on the Holzer files, because again, it's easy to jump down the lane that everything is demonic and means you harm, when in fact, if you read the room, maybe you were offensive to the spirit and it was doing to you what it would have done in human form had you disrespected them in their own home.
And you kind of answered the next thing I was going to say. You preempted what I was going to tell you, because the one fact we know, the only death in the house was Mr. Pritchard, Joe. And Joe was he has been allegedly seen by a number of witnesses inside the house since his death also. Whether that's, you know, true or not, I can't tell you, but it is a fact that he died in the house on the bathroom floor upstairs. And again, that type of mining personality, you know, these are guys that are more than willing to throw down with you if they don't like you. And how must it feel for him? We're invading his space. You know, who are these strangers in my house? They're acting like they own the place. You know, they're not listening to me. They're not engaging me. They're, you know, what's going on? So I find it equally likely that we're dealing with a confused or a frustrated human spirit than anything dark and negative.
I agree. You've got to be more cautious in how you define what it is that you're up against, and sometimes taking that step back. I know, again, not meaning to keep going back to it, but on a recent episode that we filmed of the Holzer files, something happens, and instead of running from it or just assuming it's the devil incarnate, you know, I try to approach it and set boundaries with, you know, this is not acceptable behavior. This is not what we do. If you want to communicate. And it was pretty interesting how things evolved from there. So you're right. Sometimes in giving it the knowledge, okay, listen, this may work on the punks that sneak in here and try to investigate or rile things up or play with Ouija boards. I'm not that guy. So if you want to communicate, let's do this like humans, right? Let's do this as rational adults. And it's amazing what kind of response you can get.
Well, and you're seasoned enough to know that respect is generally the right answer in any situation in life, correct? You know, you can't go too far wrong in most cases by taking the respectful approach. So if you go in there, you do respect boundaries. Listen, we are here, okay? We are going to be your guests, your housemates for the next few days. We're going to be polite and courteous and so forth, and we would love to communicate with you, okay? But we can understand why you might not want us here, in which case, sorry, but we'll be out of your hair until, you know, we'll be out of your hair by Friday, and then you've got 2 days off until Nick and Katrina move in on Monday.
That's right.
So... Yeah, and that approach, you know, it definitely got us results. And this wasn't a spectacular case for me personally, in terms of we got some very solid evidence. We got some good EVPs. We got that scratch, some physical interaction. As an investigator, I'm more than grateful for that. Like, I feel like that was a plenty. Other witnesses I talked to had experienced more spectacular things. Like I said, the growling from the coal hole and what sounded like claws scratching the inside of the coal house door. I thought that that was a fascinating thing, but we didn't experience that for ourselves. I brought in a friend of mine called Leslie, who has worked with me on a number of hauntings. She walked into the house within 5 minutes. She's projectile vomiting in the toilet. She said, the atmosphere here is just off the chair. How are you in here? You know, it just does not feel right. I have my cell phone slide about a foot across the table surface in the living room while I was sitting at the top of the stairs trying to communicate with EVPs. So it was an active house. But it's interesting. There's a lot of controversy about this haunting online. There are some people out there that will say, well, I went there for a night and nothing happened. It's all a fraud. It's all a crock. You know, which, of course, is not how this works. And the truth of it is that there are now, I would say, hundreds, if not thousands of people that have experienced strange things at the house. While I was there, for example, there was a knock on the door and it was a utilities guy, you know, the people that work for the gas company. And he said, hey, sorry to bother you. This is the ghost house, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, I've got the new guy with me today. He's heard about this place. Do you mind if he has a quick look around? So they'd heard stories, and people that come to fix the gas and people that do maintenance of the house, they've had experiences. So it's a very, very broad base of people that have had strange things go on inside this house, even the police.
All right. Now, when you are going in, I mean, try to explain to people too. Obviously, you're not going in just to prove there are ghosts there. What exactly is the, you know, the overwhelming arc of the visit? What are you really hoping to accomplish during that 5 day period?
So I've got all these testable claims, right? Having interviewed so many witnesses and having read the literature on the house, there are all these various testable claims, and I don't go in to prove the existence of ghosts or the non-existence of ghosts. I'm going in there to personally experience the place for myself in kind of a selfish way, Dave. A lot of what I do with these books, they're my vacations. Like, I'm not a sit on a beach kind of guy. I'm fascinated with these old and haunted places, so I want to go experience them for myself. And we went a long way to investigate Pontefract. You know, that's a long way to travel, but it was a bucket list location, and I just want to know what the real story is. And if it leads me towards ghosts, that's great. And if it leads me towards the house not being haunted, you know, I feel like I can still contribute something by debunking what others claim to have experienced there. It's that old saying about follow the evidence wherever it leads.
How does the rest of the time there unfold for you? Is it just slowly amping up through the whole time? Do you kind of plateau out? Does it just stop altogether?
Exactly the opposite. It started on a high and it actually petered out. So we're looking at a downward slope, which is exactly the opposite of what you would expect, right? You expect things to build and build and build. This started out high and then it petered out. And the house was empty for 2 days. Nick and Katrina moved in and it was insane for them. Absolutely off the chain. If you saw that episode of Paranormal Lockdown, which was their 2-hour Halloween special for season 2, they captured a shadow figure, a very distinct shadow figure, walking past the living room doorway. On video, it was an amazing piece of footage. They recorded black, smudge-like objects, almost the size of a mouse or a rat, scurrying across the floor, except, of course, they're not mice or rats. Something entirely different. They had physical scratches and were attacked themselves. So they had a very intense 72 hours. And, I had quite a bit of jealousy, to tell you the truth. I feel like we primed the pump for them. But it just keeps going back to the whole, you know, there's no way to tell when is the right time, what is the right mix of people, are the weather conditions right, how are the atmospherics, and 100 other factors that all go into how active your time at the house is going to be. And I remind myself over and over again, what I got was incredible. I got several pieces of excellent, I think, evidence, even though some of it was just experiential, and great EVPs, and I'm very content with that.
The haunting continues to be powerful. Do we have any idea why? Is there something regarding the geology of the location, something about that specific area that makes it so ripe for this type of activity?
Other than it being built on a battlefield, We do know that this was one of the last houses to be built on that particular estate. And one thing that fascinates me, too, is what experiences do others have in the neighborhood? And there seems to be an equal split. There are those that just laugh and say, you know, they'll roll their eyes when you mention it. And there are others who'll say, yeah, odd things do happen to me. At least one neighbor Bill interviewed was told, seemed not quite an annoyed person a little further down the street, and said, you know, we get this black shadowy figure comes running past our windows in the evening. It's not a person. It's, you know, it's like a shadowy hooded figure. Can you keep your monk under control?
Awesome.
Which I thought was just terrific.
Keep your monk under control, sir.
The most English thing you could say, isn't it? Would you mind awfully keeping your monk under control? So I would not be at all surprised to discover that there was something in the ground, whether it's geologic, as you posited, Dave, you know, whether it's water, whether it's one of 100 other factors, I don't know. I've never done a geologic survey there. But it continues to, as you said, be very active to this day. And it's a very feast or famine location. You can get activity off the chain, or you can get absolutely nothing and a peaceful night's sleep. There's also been some remarkable photographic evidence captured at 3rd East Drive. And if you go to the website for it, the 3rdeastdrive.com website, Bill has posted a lot of photographs that people have gotten in the house up there. And one of the more remarkable ones is it looks as though the photographer has captured the sleeve and the arm of somebody holding a rosary coming down the main staircase.
All right. Well, then that goes beyond just the concept of maybe it's an amorphous blob of energy that never walked in human form. Obviously, it's definitely taking on that form of the monk.
But it could be exactly what you said. It could be that amorphous blob which is able to choose its form, you know, and there may be an element of showmanship of showing people what it wants them to see.
This place, you said, was definitely one of the more frightening locations to investigate. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is a place that the energy could be cleared from it? Or do you think that there is still a mystery that needs to be resolved in order for this haunting to finally ease up or go away?
You know, my first suspicion on this would be, because of the constant stream of visitors, if you were to cut off that oxygen supply, if you were to just close the house up and leave it. My first thought on it was that, you know, you might just extinguish it in the same way you extinguish a fire. You remove its fuel source. But then I was reminded of the fact that the house was actually dormant. It was empty. After Mrs. Pritchard sold it and moved out, she put it on the market, I should say, and then moved out. It did sit dormant for quite a while. And it was on the sales market for a while with nobody in it. And a local investigator called Andy Evans got access to the house and was allowed to come in and do one or two sessions himself. He did quite a few sessions himself just to see if it was still active, and found the house was active even then. So he wrote a great book about it called Don't Look Back in Anger. I recommend anybody interested in the case check out Andy's book. I think it's so strong at this point. I think it's so ingrained in the fabric of that structure that it's not going away. I don't think you could bless it away. I don't think you could banish or exorcise or whatever you want to call it. Now, Bill's one policy is, and this is posted very clearly on the front door, he does not allow Ouija boards inside the house, ever. He has a very real concern, I would even call it a fear, of antagonizing Fred or whatever the entity in the house is. So he won't allow spirit boards to be used inside the house. And that's for those rare few that break that, they get banned from ever returning to the house. So I think as long as people investigate, I think the phenomena will continue. And one thing that I think we often neglect in this field with people like you, me, Tim, and your listeners, you know, we are paranormal people, right? I mean, you, Dave Schrader, you go to how many haunted locations a year? 30, 40, 50?
No, I mean, I get about a dozen or so at least a year. And then if we go do the foreign trips, you know, we might fit in another 12 there. But anywhere from 5 to 30 in a year.
So let's go with 15 and split the difference, yeah? And you go to some very active places. So why, if we imagine people that have the same hobbies as we do, the same profession as you do, I have a real sneaking suspicion that we can attract this stuff to us, and then we can unwittingly take it to the next location, in the same way that you can inadvertently track mud into somebody's house and ruin their nice clean carpet. When you have that many paranormal enthusiasts visiting your location after they've been to a number of others, I mean, the year I went to East Drive myself, Dave, I'd just done Bobby Mackey's, I'd just done Waverly Hills, I'd just done Asylum 49, and a bunch of help cases. It would not surprise me at all to see that we are spreading these kind of things ourselves.
No, I could see that, and especially if there is any truth to the concept that a specific area might be a ripe battery for the paranormal, right? You've got the right geologic modes, maybe underground current of water, ley lines, whatever. If you have your own baggage of spiritual activity, who's to say it might not stay in some of these places because, A, it's attracted to the energy that's there, or B, the attention that people seem to be pouring out in those locations.
Yeah, I saw some of that when I was doing ghost tours of the Stanley Hotel in Esther's, not Easter's, Park, and had to slip that one in. Sorry, Dave.
I like it.
And you know, the guys that did the paranormal research there, they had discovered that they were interacting with spirits that seemed to have no connection to the hotel itself, and realized that the number of visitors that come to a hotel like that every year, you know, one or two of them bring something with them, and these spirits seem to say, you know what? I kind of dig this place a lot more than your condo. I'm going to stay here. Thanks for the ride. And I think that they stick around, that they move on, that they're attracted to something, whether it's a different energy, you know, a different vibe, or just a change of scene, who knows? But I do wonder how often this happens to us. And the reason it's been on my mind lately, not to make light of it, but, you know, the current COVID-19 situation, looking at models of how viruses spread. You know, I do wonder, we in the paranormal field, we come in contact with one another quite often, and we all go to the same places and we do the same stuff. Do we pass this stuff on one to the other?
I don't know. It certainly leaves you scratching your head to wonder. Richard, it's always great to catch up with you. And I know you've got another book. Let's tease it. It's coming out soon. What is the new book, and how soon can people be looking for it?
The book should be out in July. It's called The Hanging Pit, The Haunting of Bodmin Jail. And it looks at the time I spent doing time in one of the world's most haunted historic prisons in Cornwall, England. So look for that in July.
Great. We will be keeping an eye out for that. Great to chat with you again, and be safe out there. Hopefully we'll see you on our TVs again soon once things have freed up and you're able to get back to filming.
And right back at you, Dave. Exactly the same. Thank you so much, and always a pleasure.
Great catching up with you. Great catching up with all of you. Thank you for tuning in to the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. Remember, this Thursday, the fourth and final special that I'm a part of with the Ghost Brothers will be airing on Travel Channel. I hope you will all tune in and check that out. I think it's the Ghost Brothers House Party, and I will be walking them through some of their scariest and funniest moments on the Ghost Brothers TV series. And remember, if you like these specials, these one-offs, contact the Travel Channel. Let them know you want more. And hopefully we'll be back with other episodes of other shows. So check that out for yourself. We'll be back Tuesday with True Crime Tuesday. All the best that is paranormal and true crime talk radio is Darkness Radio.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.